This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. Jam Gajar is a neurosurgeon who specializes in brain trauma. He deals with brain injuries resulting from car accidents, falls, beatings, and gunshot wounds. His ambition is not only to save lives, but to better understand the nature of human consciousness. Dr. Gajar is considered one of the country's leading brain trauma specialists. He's an attending neurosurgeon at the New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center in Manhattan. Through his affiliation with the Brain Trauma Foundation, he helped draft the first ever guidelines for the management of severe head injury. I asked Dr. Gajar if he typically finds physical brain damage in his comatose patients.
We're talking about people with severe head injury, which is people in a coma. Of course, there's other types of head injury, minor head injury where somebody hits their head and then recovers and seems to be normal. And then moderate head injury where somebody has a head injury and is kind of sleepy, but they're not in a coma. In coma, they don't open their eyes. And in those patients who are comatose, usually there is a brain injury. The brain is physically damaged in some sense. There may or may not be a skull fracture. And that's important to know. You don't have to have a skull fracture to have a brain injury. The brain can rock inside the skull and be actually physically damaged from hitting the inside of the skull itself without having something come through and crush the skull and directly impact the brain.
What's the first thing you do when a patient comes in and you're trying to analyze what the problem is and therefore what the treatment should be?
Yeah, we have a very good system in the United States. It was started by the American College of Surgeons, and it's the Advanced Trauma Life Support system where there's a trauma team in the trauma center, and they see the patient immediately when they come in, and they follow the ABCs, airway, breathing, and circulation. They make sure the patient's got an airway, they're breathing, and they've got blood circulation, because before you do anything, you have to be assured of that. It doesn't matter what kind of brain injury there is or what kind of leg fractures or other internal injuries they may have. If they don't have a blood pressure, if they don't have an airway, it's no use fixing that. So the first thing they do is ABC, airway, breathing, and circulation. That's what you see in emergency room shows where the patient comes in and nurses and doctors are all around the patient. They're basically making sure they have airway, they're breathing, and they have adequate circulation. After that's ensured, then they look at other systems for injury, such as the head.
What are the phases of the typical brain injury, if there is such a thing as a typical brain injury?
Well, a typical severe brain injury, where somebody comes in a coma, and supposing they do make it to the emergency room, of 60,000 deaths in the United States from brain injury, 40,000 die at the scene or in the emergency room. Another 20,000 die in the hospital. Supposing they make it to the emergency room and they do the ABCs and the patient has an airway, is breathing, and has circulation, then the patient goes through certain other phases. And as a neurosurgeon, what I do and many other neurosurgeons throughout the country that take call at trauma centers, we come in and evaluate the brain and the spine for injury. And usually the first thing we do after they do the ABCs and they have the circulation is we do a neurological examination. And that basically consists of how the patient is moving and what their pupils, if they react to light, or the asymmetric. Once we have that exam, then we go and get a CAT scan of the brain, which is a special scan of the brain to see if there's any injuries. And the main thing that I'm looking for is a blood clot that can be removed and give the brain some room, because what happens and what kills most of these patients is brain swelling. And it's remarkable because, and a lot of research has been done on this and it's continuing to be done, as there may be a very small portion of the brain that's injured, say, in the car accident. But what happens is the whole brain reacts to this small injury and swells up tremendously. And that actually can kill the patient. And so what we're trying to do in the first couple of days is reduce that swelling and preserve brain, because a lot of these patients can make a good recovery if the primary, the initial brain injury, is not too severe.
How do you reduce the swelling?
Well, what I do is I put a tube in the brain, and many other neurosurgeons do this. We put a tube in the brain that hits the middle of the brain where there's spinal fluid, and we all make about a half a liter of spinal fluid every day, and it circulates around the brain. By putting this tube in, we can drain the spinal fluid if the pressure gets too high. So through the tube, we can measure the pressure in the brain, and when the pressure is too high, we can just drain the spinal fluid. That's one mechanism of reducing the pressure. One very important way of making sure that, that brain swelling doesn't get too severe is to maintain the blood pressure, little simple things like that. Then we go on to more sophisticated measures if there continues to be brain swelling.
Neurosurgeon Dr. Jam Gajar is my guest. I'd like you to choose a case that you've worked on, and maybe we could talk a little bit about the specific case. Maybe we'll talk about a woman who was beaten over the summer in Central Park, whose life you helped save. What brought her there? How severely was she beaten? What kind of shape was she in when you first saw her?
Yeah, that was a well-publicized case, and I think people can relate to that. It was a young woman who was walking in Central Park at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a piano teacher, and she was severely assaulted by a man they've since caught, and she was beaten severely about the head. I mean, when she came into the emergency room and I saw her, her head was swollen size of a pumpkin. In fact, her parents were on vacation at the time. Her boyfriend was out of the country. And she wasn't identified because the police sketches of her were of this pumpkin-sized head that had no relation to what she really looked like. So she remained unidentified for a few days, which was of great concern to all of us who are New Yorkers, feeling that we can be so lonely in such a time of need. And fortunately, her parents did come back, and she had a very, very, very close and loving family, which helped tremendously. But anyway, she came into the emergency room, and again, the ABCs were followed. She had a tube placed down her throat for breathing. She had fluids to go in to maintain her circulation. And she had a CAT scan done. At the time, it showed her brain was contused or damaged in the front part of it. And she had a small part in the temporal or side of her brain. And at the time that first CAT scan was done, they were just very small hemorrhages, not enough to operate on. We put a tube in the brain to monitor the pressure and started draining spinal fluid. And that evening, her pressure, in spite of the drainage, her pressure suddenly got very high. Now, that's a great concern to us when there's a sudden change like that. Of course, we're thinking that one of these small brain contusions would develop into a much larger blood clot. And indeed, when we got the second brain scan that day, the front part, the right frontal part of her brain, had a massive hemorrhage, and her pressure was uncontrolled at that time. So I took her to the operating room and did a craniotomy, which is a neurosurgical term for removing the skull and opening the covering of the brain. She had a large clot which just came out immediately, and and the brain was very, very swollen to the point that I really couldn't put the bone back in, which I normally do, and in some trauma cases, when the swelling's a lot, you can't put the bone back. So I had it stored for use later. The pressure was very high, and we had to go into another mode, which is called cerebral perfusion pressure management, which is a medical term for raising the blood pressure to get enough blood through the brain.
While you're doing these really invasive procedures, like sawing through the cranium to drain blood out of the brain, how do you know if you're further damaging the person's brain by probing around like that?
Right.
I mean, you're actually using a saw and a drill to do all of this.
Right. Well, this is taking a round piece of skull off, and that's outside the brain. I mean, these operations are done every day in the United States for tumors or blood clots and other conditions, and just taking off the bone does not hurt the brain. What she was suffering from was this blood clot that was putting a tremendous amount of pressure on her brain. So the operation per se does not harm the brain. The blood clot was harming her, and so this had to be removed.
My guest is neurosurgeon Jam Gajar. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with neurosurgeon Dr. Jam Gajar. He specializes in treating brain injuries. Now, the woman who was beaten in Central Park, she was in a coma when she arrived. How long did she stay in the coma?
She was in the coma for about a week. Now, the definition of coma is that you don't open your eyes to any stimulation. And she indeed had her eyes completely closed for a week, and about the eighth day, if my memory is correct, about the eighth day she opened her eyes when she got pinched. And in patients that survive the first week, that's kind of the standard thing, that they'll open their eyes. At that point, we're out of the phase of worrying about high pressure in the brain, which occurs in the first week. So there's several phases they go through, and it's, you know, there have been a lot of films, I don't want to name the titles, but there are a lot of films that have been out recently which show people in a coma from a car accident, let's say, and suddenly, you know, they wake up and they're normal. That doesn't happen with severe head injury. It's a very slow recovery. And at any point, they can plateau and not improve.
So at some point, you pinch a patient who's in a coma, hoping that that pinch is going to provoke them back into consciousness. What else do you do while they're in a coma to monitor how their brain is functioning or how much permanent damage there's been?
Well, the main thing we do is the pressure monitoring. There's new methods coming out, which will soon measure chemicals in the brain and oxygen tension, things like that. But right now, the standard monitoring technique is to monitor the pressure. And that, along with looking at the pupils and looking how they move when you pinch them, do they move their arms up and pull your hand away, or do they extend away from you or not move at all, which is a very bad response, and has those motor responses of how in the first week are actually prognostic. In people that don't move the right way or don't move at all, those people tend to have a poor outcome, whereas people who move appropriately when stimulated, those people tend to have a better outcome. So it's the pupils, the motor response, and the pressure in the head that generally guide us in terms of how much brain damage there is.
When the woman who we've been discussing who was beaten in Central Park was in the coma, did you talk to her? Do you believe that people in a coma will somehow register what's said to them?
If they do, they won't remember it. So it's kind of moot. If sometimes in the first week when patients are in a coma, if the family's around talking to them, occasionally you see, especially if they're in a light coma, the pulse will, their pulse will go up, their blood pressure may rise, and so on, which is all sort of indications that they're aware of something going on. But certainly when these patients wake up and you ask them later, do you remember being in the intensive care unit? They say, no, I don't remember any of it. So if they are responsive, you know, if they do hear their loved ones, they make no response, they make no motion that they do, and certainly later on they don't remember it. So it's kind of moot. What we don't like to do in the first week is give the patients too much stimulation, because if indeed they do have high pressure in their head and they're stimulated, that may raise it further and be deleterious. So we really don't want too much stimulation. I usually tell the family to hold their loved one, or, you know, but try not to talk or stimulate them too much.
What was her first response after you pinched her and she opened her eyes?
Elated. The family and I were just totally elated because I didn't tell you. Because what happened was, towards the end of the week, her pressure went up again. She required another operation, which is quite unusual. So she had another craniotomy to remove another blood clot in the side of her brain. So she had two large blood clots, and she was a difficult case to manage because the pressure was very high. We had to do usually. We're talking, this kind of patient is about 10%, 15% of all severe head injury patients, where it really requires a very sophisticated level of monitoring and treatment. But, you know, she opened her eyes at day, and it's really amazing. No matter what happens in that first week, if they pull through, or no matter what kind of injury they have, they all seem to open their eyes in the second week. Now, about 20% of patients will die from severe head injury. We can get into historically how that's improved. The outcome from severe head injuries are improved dramatically over the last 20 years. It's gone from half the people dying in the 70s to 35% dying in the 80s to now we're getting numbers reported of 20%, with the survivors going on to have a good outcome. And I think that's very important to say that we're not rescuing vegetables, that these people are going on to have a good quality of life. And indeed, the Central Park person went through several phases, and now she's, the accident was in early June, and she's home. Her family says that she's back to what she was before the assault. She has some problems with her short-term memory, but otherwise has done great.
Does she still play piano? She was a piano teacher. And I know there was some question about whether she would maintain her skills as a player after she recovered. Did she?
Yes, she's playing simple piano. She's not playing anything sophisticated right now. But
now, how much of that is memory and how much of that is motor coordination? Do you know?
Both. You need to have the memory and you need to have the motor coordination. She wrote me a letter. Her handwriting looks perfect. You know, I think coordination in her is not a problem. As far as her integrating, she's also writing music. She's writing music, but I asked her if she's playing anything like Chopin. She said, not yet, but she's playing the Beatles. this is early. I mean, you have to really wait, I'd say December or January. We usually give them 6 months after the injury. And as far as their motor skills, they're about 90% of where they're going to end up.
Does she have any memory of being beaten?
I don't believe so. No, I don't, you know, I think that...
And you don't think that'll come back to her either?
It may come back, but as of a couple of months ago, I don't think she remembers it. I think
is that typical?
Typically, patients with severe brain injury will not recall the accident and will actually forget a lot of the events before the accident. And as time goes on, they remember more and more closer to the accident, but they never, all the patients I've had never remember the actual accident.
Does the
sense? I think that's because the part of the brain that lays down memory is very sensitive to trauma. It's very sensitive to alcohol too. I mean, people that get drunk often get very drunk, cannot remember what happened, say, and that's because that part of the brain is very sensitive to alcohol, lack of oxygen, trauma, and so on. So you get a head bump, that area gets shook up, and for whatever reason, the memory's not laid down, and you can never recall it.
Are there questions you like to ask patients after they are well into the recovery process about what they remember about their recovery or life right before it? In other words, things to give you insights about how the brain works, because I imagine you can learn a lot about how the brain works as a neurosurgeon.
Certainly. Certainly. We see all kinds of brain injury and recovery from brain injuries and brain tumors and so on. I feel very privileged to be able to see all this. And the brain is an amazing organ that I think is still... we know very, very little about it, and constantly exploring it, and I think there'll be more questions than answers. But what's very interesting to me is why these patients are in a coma for almost exactly a week. I mean, it's sort of unvarying, and then, you know, if they don't die during that week, they seem to wake up in the second week, and there's a slow recovery. And when I talk to my rehabilitation doctors, friends, they tell me that it's true that no matter what the primary brain injury, whatever brain damage they have, which can be extremely varied, you know, a lot of people, it's the front part of the brain, but some of the people get the side of the brain or whatever, different parts of the brain can be injured. No matter what that is, it seems like everybody goes to the same stages of recovery, which says that the whole brain is reacting to the injury rather than a small part of it and then recovering. But what's fascinating is and my laboratory is doing research on this right now, looking at how the brain reacts to this injury and why does the whole brain swell in reaction to a small part of brain injury. And it seems that the brain's releasing these chemicals which act as inflammatory mediators and cause the whole brain to swell. And we're looking at ways of blocking that. There's certain other things going on too, and there are drug trials going on in the United States to try and see if we can give drugs to prevent the brain from swelling up. But for right now, we have I think good critical care. of these patients when they come in and during the first week and prevent a lot of the further injury that occurs.
Do you think that coma has a function? In other words, is the brain more likely to heal if it shuts down for a while?
That's a very interesting hypothesis, and in other areas of coma, it's been postulated the brain has an early shutdown mechanism to preserve itself during a time when there's injury, there's ongoing injury. And it's a tough question to ask, I mean, to answer, because it's sort of a catch-22. Does the brain shut down early and preserve itself, or does it shut down as a response to the injury?
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult. It's a very good question. But we know that studying the brain, that there is a shutdown of the metabolism and oxygen consumption, that when a brain's in a coma, it uses a lot less energy than when it's awake.
Dr. Jem Gajar is an attending neurosurgeon at the New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center in Manhattan and is president of the Aitken Neuroscience Institute. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with neurosurgeon Dr. Jem Gajar. He specializes in treating brain injuries resulting from car accidents, falls, beatings, and gunshot wounds. He works in Manhattan at the New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center. Many of his patients arrive at the hospital in a coma. When you're treating somebody who's in a coma, do you think of them as being in this almost otherworldly state?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're not... It's almost a little bit of a problem, actually, because it looks like they have a foot in the grave. I mean, there they are lying there, unresponsive, their eyes are closed, they have tubes coming out of everywhere. And, you know, I think that if they're awake and crying out and say, you know, please help me, please help me, please help me, it would have been more research and clinical investigation would be done in these patients. And I think, unfortunately, especially in the 70s and before then, that the outcome of these patients is so dismal that there's still the feeling among some neurosurgeons and critical care physicians that these patients make such a horrible outcome. Why should we really pursue their recovery vigorously? When they open their eyes, they seem to have come out of that other world. But they're not there yet. That second week's very interesting because they open their eyes, but there's no purposeful interaction with the environment. You ask them to follow commands, they won't do that. They'll just open their eyes. That's called arousal. That's the first stage. Then about a week later, a few days later, they'll start following commands, which is conscious behavior, and that's what you really want to see. The worst thing is for them to open their eyes and not do anything, which is a vegetative state. So they seem to be passing, as you say, through different states or different worlds. There's the comatose, no response, eyes closed, and the vegetative, eyes are open, but nobody's home. And then gradually they make a response over time and wake up slowly.
Is it part of your work to guide them from the coma state into the back in the world state, to give them orders that they can respond to and to try to engage them back into life?
Yeah, I think the doctor's and nurse's role is really to try and prevent further injury. And the brain recovers on its own to a large extent. I mean, there isn't... The first week is really a lot of medical and surgical management. The patient leaves the intensive care unit after about 3 weeks and goes into rehabilitation and stays there for a couple of months. And there they really do a lot of therapy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and importantly for the brain, cognitive therapy, which is getting them to learn again and learn to walk, learn to speak, learn to do a lot of the tasks they took for granted. One of the major problems with head injury patients is attention, and that's because the frontal lobes, the front part of the brain, is usually hit because you're looking at wherever you're going, whether it's a car accident or a fall or whatever. It's usually the front part of the brain that gets damaged, and that's responsible for your attention, your personality, control of your behavior. And see, there's a lot of personality problems, behavioral problems initially, attention problems. And even for minor head injury, I have lots of patients that come into me who our executives and bumped their head or fell down and maybe didn't even lose consciousness, but have a heck of a time afterwards really concentrating. It can be devastating if you can't pay attention to a task for more than a couple of minutes.
Dr. Jam Gajar is my guest. He's a neurosurgeon, president of the Aitken Neuroscience Institute, chief of neurosurgery at Jamaica Hospital in Queens. We talked a little bit about the victim from Central Park who you treated, and she was the victim of a beating. You treat a lot of people who are the victims of gunshots. Mm-hmm. If the bullet has actually penetrated a part of the brain, is your approach to treating the victim very different than say, a beating injury, where some of the brain has actually been cut away by the mm-hmm. bullet?
No. I mean, this is one thing I'd like to clear up, is that we're just as aggressive with a gunshot wound as with a car accident. But this whole notion that if a part of the brain is, that every part of the brain is absolutely 100% essential to your normal functioning. And for the most part, that's true. But there are areas of the brain, small portions of the brain, which, if damaged, you really can't tell that there's any difference in the person. Because there's parallel systems that take over and so on. And since a lot of this damage is the frontal part of the brain, especially the right frontal part of the brain, if it's a small portion of that that's damaged, people can make a very good recovery. Now, gunshot wounds are difficult to treat, especially when they're high-velocity gunshot wounds, because they cause a tremendous amount of swelling. And I'll tell you one case tremendous was a young woman who worked in, I might say, by the way, in New York City, it is true, crime is down. And over the past 3 years, we've seen very few gunshot wounds. It used to be 4 or 5 years ago, we'd see about half the patients had gunshot wounds and half of them were car accidents. And now it's almost rare to see a gunshot wound to the head, and crime has come down so much. But be as that may, when I had a patient, it's about 5 years ago, who worked at an ice cream store here in Manhattan, and she was shot in the head 3 times. She was brought to the emergency room in a very deep coma, and when I did the scan, I thought, well, that's it. She's not going to even make it through the scan. But we went ahead and we put the tube in her brain and monitored her. And, the question comes, did you take out the bullets? And the answer is, we don't. What we're really concerned about is the brain swelling. The bullet itself, it tends to, depending on where it is, a lot of times we will not take it out until later on when the swelling goes down. And indeed, she had a bullet that was in the back of her head. And because it was so heavy, it sort of came back and back and back and eventually lied right next to the skull, so it was quite easy to take out. He did that about 2 weeks later. But, she made a good recovery. And with bullet wounds, you know exactly where the injury is because the bullet goes right through, whereas a car accident, sometimes the brain shakes up inside the skull and you get little tiny tears you can't see on the CAT scan. But certainly a gunshot wound, exactly where the bullet went. And certainly our rule is trying to minimize the damage to just the bullet track. And she woke up and she was, basically the bullet had gone through a part of the brain that responsible for vision on one side. So she was blind on one side. And she had some heightened sensation on one side of her body, but otherwise made a good recovery. I can't go through every case describing it, but just to say that just because somebody has a gunshot wound to the head is not reason to, if they're making some kind of response and they're not brain dead, we usually pursue them vigorously and try and treat them.
Have you ever been in a coma, or has anyone close to you been in one?
Well, I had a head injury when I was 7 years old.
What happened?
I was a California beach brat, and I got into a fight with another kid and got hit in the head. quite severely, and still have a scar over my right eye to remind me of that incident. And I passed out and then came to and had stitches in my head. My real experience with brain injury was from my older sister, who's retarded, and she was born. She looks normal, but I think that the time of delivery, my mother didn't get enough oxygen, and that created some brain injury in my sister. And I grew up with her, and there are many people in the country who have family members who are disabled in this manner. And you really, I don't know, as a child, I guess you're growing up, I was always trying to figure out how to make her better, you know, how to make her normal. And it was almost like forcing her every day to make her normal. I couldn't figure it out. And I think that was one of the reasons I went into studying the brain.
If you could get the answer to one or two questions, what would those one or two questions be?
Well,
questions about the mystery surrounding how the brain works.
Well, my interest is really the nature of consciousness. What are the basic mechanisms of consciousness?
Mm-hmm.
What are the substrates of that? What are the anatomical and biochemical substrates of consciousness? You know, what is it that makes us conscious, sentient beings? It lies in the brain, but what are those mechanisms? And there's other, I mean, the questions I explored when I was undergraduate student at UCLA at the Brain Research Institute, and you know, why do we sleep? We still haven't answered that question. Well, because you're tired. Well, that doesn't answer it. you know, why is it we spend, you know, a third of our lives in this altered state? I think that those are my fascination. Really, is the brain is an integrative organ. How does it do it? And how does it maintain consciousness?
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, well, thank you.
Dr. Jam Gajar is an attending neurosurgeon at the New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center in Manhattan and is president of the Aitken Neuroscience Institute. This is Fresh Air.